tonight on Arena. Becoming, The Whistlers and Infinite Football are the movies up for review. And where do I begin with Kate Bush? #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we'll start, as usual, on Thursday night with film reviews. As you know, cinemas are closed right now, but films are still becoming available on streaming devices and platforms. We're looking at three of those films this evening. Becoming, a documentary based on the promotional tour former First Lady Michelle Obama did for her book, Becoming. And then we have two Romanian films from director Corneliu Porumboiu. One, a thriller called The Whistlers, and the second, a documentary called Infinite Football. Reviewers this evening, Chris Wasser and Roe McDermott. And let's start with Becoming, and in fact, let's start with a clip. Chicago was the first stop for Southside native Michelle Obama on her Becoming book tour. And she was interviewed there by Oprah Winfrey. Oprah asks Michelle Obama about her last day in the White House.
When you got on the helicopter, did you think, free at last, free at last? Or did you, or was it bittersweet, or what was it?
Yeah, it was that whole day was a trip, first of all. For so many reasons. So what was happening on our last day was that Sasha's and Malia's friends, who had grown up in the White House, came to me that night and was like, we want sleepover. And I'm like, what? You want a sleepover? We're gonna miss being here. We want our last breakfast. Because you can get what you want to eat at the White House. So all those little girls were like, I think I'll have the fried chicken biscuit and I'm gonna have the waffle. So this is what, we're trying to move. And then they wake up and I gotta get them out. It's like, come on, wake up. The Trumps are coming. You got to get up, get out, you know? And there are tears and there's crying and the staff is crying and I'm trying not to cry because I said if I walk out there crying, they're gonna swear I'm crying for a different reason.
Yeah, for sure.
So I'm like, we have got to get it together. So it was a very emotional day. But then we got on Air Force One, and when I got on the plane, I think I sobbed.
You did?
For 30 minutes. And I think it was just the release of 8 years of trying to do everything perfectly.
Michelle Obama there speaking to Oprah Winfrey in one of the clips from her film, the film Becoming, which is in itself a documentary based on the promotional tour of Obama's book, Becoming, a memoir. Chris Wasser and Roe McDermott, as I said, are reviewers this evening. It's safe enough to say that this Netflix documentary, Chris, it really is a companion piece to the book.
Absolutely, Sean. And I think it's relying on audiences to be familiar with the book, which was actually released almost 2 years ago. And I kind of looked at it as more of a bonus visual chapter in that, you know, it's an extension of the book. We're going on tour with Michelle, documentary maker Nadia Hallgren. She actually followed Michelle on this extensive and extravagant at times stadium tour where Michelle Obama was introduced and interviewed by celebrity moderators. So you heard Oprah Winfrey in the clip there. She was also interviewed by Stephen Colbert, Reese Witherspoon at one stage, and they were basically just asking her questions about everything she would have covered in the book. And along the way then, you know, in between these live snippets, Michelle also, you know, has the decency, I did say, you know, it does rely on you reading the book, but there are flashbacks. Michelle talks about, you know, her upbringing. She reminds us of of who her mother is, who her father was. She talks about the fact that her father was denied a college education when he was younger and how that affected the family. And she also kind of, you know, it gives us a snapshot as well of what life was like in the White House, following on from her comments there in that interview with Oprah. But the thing that really stands out about this film that you don't get with the book is that on every stop on the tour, which went all around America and also included a date in London at one stage, she sat down with teenagers, especially on the American leg of the tour. She sat down with local teenagers to basically, you know, local students, to talk about what kind of America they want to grow up in and to talk about their experiences of growing up in America at the moment.
I think it's safe to say again, Ro, that none of those moderators were going to put thumbscrews on Michelle Obama when it came to asking questions. And the familiarity of the audience with the book was very obvious. It almost sounded sometimes in that clip the little in-jokes between her and the several thousand people, it has to be said, that were in these very large arenas that, that she went to. What kind of insight do we get into Michelle Obama from this film?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that this documentary was initiated and overseen by the Obama's own production company, Higher Grounds Production, and it's been distributed by Netflix, which has a business arrangement with the Obamas. And so it doesn't really become an interrogative documentary. This isn't impartial. But I think that's the thing. Like, anyone who is watching this documentary is like the people who turn up to Michelle Obama's book tour. There are people who care about her. There are people who are interested in what she has to say. And so while it doesn't become incredibly insightful or deep in that way, that she isn't challenged on her views in any way, I think it is a nice snapshot, and particularly for the many, many people who are very justified in their love of Michelle Obama, it taps into something that I think we don't get on the book as much, is that you see just how personable she is and how funny she is, and you get insights into how she kind of tries to rebel against the sanitized life while she's in the White House, how she is beaten down to some degree in the White House, and then how she is feeling more free now that she is out of the White House and allowed to speak her mind in a much freer way. So she isn't challenged to the same degree that kind of an impartial documentary would be, or an objective documentary would be. But I think you do get beautiful insights. And to me, some of the most beautiful moments come from those meet and greet moments, the moments where she's being off the cuff with people, where she's meeting people. And you see how brilliantly she's able to connect with individuals. Just, you know, meeting them for the first time, usually they're incredibly overwhelmed. But she just seems incredibly humble. And even though she is, you know, now one of the most famous women in the world and had so much power and was in such a powerful position and situation, how much she still cares about people who are growing up in America today, particularly young Black women, and making sure that they feel seen and empowered.
One of the things that is touched on in this, Chris, is the idea that as particularly during President Obama's first White House campaign, that the media reaction to Michelle Obama, it soon turned in on her. Let's have a listen to a clip, and I'll ask you to comment on it afterwards, where she's talking about, and we get a sense really of how that media reaction changed.
Over the course of the campaign, I was telling my story. I was being vulnerable.
Let me tell you something. For the first time in my adult lifetime, I'm really proud of my country. And not just because Barack has done well, but because I think people are hungry for change.
And to have that distorted, it just felt so wrong.
Does Michelle Obama dislike America?
I think that she's got a chip on her shoulder.
She's got this Stokely Carmichael in a designer dress thing going. Her instinct is to start with this blame America, you know, I'm the victim. If that's
speaking her mind can get her into trouble.
She looks like an angry woman.
She's not warm and fuzzy.
She's whining. She's about the old boy network.
And Michelle's going to have to think about what it is she's become in her life.
I stopped talking off the cuff. I stopped talking freely. I used teleprompters. I had to be much more scripted than I had ever been before.
So had you some sympathy with her in that regard, Chris Wasser? That's Michelle Obama in the film Becoming.
Oh, absolutely, Sean, because, I mean, halfway through watching this, I was thinking, right, this is, as Ro was saying, this has been produced by the Obamas. This has been produced by Higher Ground, their production company, and Netflix. And it's been made with the best intention. And that intention is to almost be this commercial for the Obama brand. Not to tell you how we got here, but you know how they got there. Let's just, you know, shine a spotlight on this book tour. So you're not going to get a warts and all examination. But what that sequence and what other sequences around it are doing it is showing you that the Obamas for 8, maybe even 10 years were scrutinized enough. And that does have leave a mark on the audience, because you're thinking, why would anybody want to put themselves in that position? Especially, I mean, it starts covering some of the front pages and some of the headlines that were, and some of the opinion pieces that were written about Michelle, which were just devastating and just changed the way they would behave. I mean, at the start there, you heard the fact that she was sobbing on Air Force One because it was almost this release, this, you know, she was finally able to not have to watch that every movement or everything she said was so perfect. That said, there are times in this documentary where I felt as though Nadia Halgren and Michelle Obama were kind of running a mile, or at least the editors were, from anything that might be deemed controversial. So you see when she sits down with the kids, and when some of the kids in some of the classrooms that she visits talk about what it's like to grow up in Trump's America, we just pull away from anything that might be controversial. And at one stage, Michelle Michelle Obama starts to talk about how she and Barack might soon be stepping out of the spotlight. And rather than following that up, because I was thinking, what exactly does that mean? We just get back to the book tour. So it is very, it just moves in a very cautious way. But I think putting all that stuff in there about how they were scrutinized before they were even in the White House is a way of letting the viewer know, listen, we had enough of this already. We're just going to run smooth.
Yeah, I wondered what they're saying. Barack might step out of the spotlight, but there was no hint as to whether she might step into a spotlight a little bit a little bit further down the line. What about race, which is spoken about at length in the book, obviously, and the fact that the Obamas might be judged purely on their skin colour? Do we get any further detail or any further insights into that in the film, Ro?
Yeah, she absolutely does talk about the fact that, you know, how much of a joke it was that when Barack Obama got elected, American rhetoric suddenly shifted to, oh, we're now living in this post-racial phase. And she exposes the hypocrisy of that through the media coverage she then got. And again, as Chris said, they kind of pull away from bringing up things explicitly like the birth certificate scandal, but they look at how Michelle Obama was viewed in a way that many black women are viewed, that she, you know, immediately people started saying like she was angry or she was aggressive or she obviously hated America when she made very, very understandable and ultimately bland statement saying, you know, I was very proud of America when Barack got elected, because to me it seemed like America finally wanted to change and do better. And then people jumped on this saying she hates America, which is, for a black person growing up in America, that is the most basic statement you could make.
Yeah, damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Absolutely. And then I think what's good about the documentary is, again, it could have absolutely gone much, much further, but it gives her the chance to point out things that are still so relevant today. For example, she starts talking about affirmative action and saying that people object to affirmative action when it benefits people of colour and black students, but they don't complain about the types of affirmative action that benefit white students, such as legacies, such as money, such as sports scholarships. And these are things that seem more relevant now because of, for example, the college admission scandal. But they don't go into in detail like, oh, let's look at this in Trump's America. So again, they are playing it safe by not getting too specific.
Yeah, and as much as she says about the Trumps is probably what she says in that Chicago clip. They arrived at the White House on the day we left. She doesn't go too much further than that. Stars from you, first of all, Ro, does it work? Does it go beyond hagiography? Is it worth watching?
I think I'm going to give it a 3.5. I really enjoyed watching it because I personally enjoy Michelle Obama and I enjoy watching her. I think there are also lovely little glimpses. She talks about going to marital counselling with Barack Obama and there are personal moments. I do feel it is very safe and it does feel sanitised. And for a documentary that talks so much about how Michelle Obama was in such a sanitised environment and had to speak very carefully, I feel like it's very careful. But fans of Michelle Obama will, of course, enjoy it.
All right. And you, Chris, stars?
I think, Sean, it's probably the closest I've seen a political documentary come to resembling a pop concert film. But I also think that that's what people were expecting and that's what people want. And you probably don't need me to tell you that Michelle Obama comes out of this extraordinarily well. I think I loved her more after watching it. Yeah. But it is more of a cinematic hagiography than a proper documentary. Maybe we'll get one of those these days. But for now, this should suffice. So I'd say 3 out of 5. It's fairly solid.
Yeah, well, it probably won't come from the Obamas themselves if it's going to be a serious critique. Let's move on then to the next two films, in fact, by the same director, Cornelio Parumboiu, Romanian director. The first of the films is The Whistlers, or to give it its Romanian title, La Gomera. First of two films from this director. This one is set in Bucharest, centred around a detective called Christy. I don't know if you want to go any further into the plot without losing us immediately, Chris, because it's very complex.
It's a little bit twisty, it's a little bit naughty, but if I can make things simple, it's Christy is a detective, he's played by Vlad Ivanov. He's in deep with the money laundering, you know, drug lords and gangsters, which he's supposed to be investigating. And long story short, when the drug lord whom he's answering to, Zolt, played by Sabin Tambre, when he's arrested, Zolt's girlfriend, Katrina Marlon, and her name in this is Gilda, she comes to Christy, she says, I want you to get Zolt out of prison, but I also need you to come to the island of La Gomera in the Canaries for some reason and to learn the ancient tradition of sabio whistling, which is an ancient form of whistling in the Spanish language. And the reason that he has to do this is so that he can continue to communicate with some of the gangsters without the police knowing what they're saying, basically. Yeah. It sounds very naughty, Sean, but all you need to know is crook detective, gangster in prison, and it's up to the detective to get the gangster out, or he will meet a very bad end.
But you do have to know about whistling, and let's listen to a clip that'll give you a sense of that. This is a character, Carlito, played by Cristobal Pinto, teaching the aforementioned Christie, that's the cop guy, played by Vlad Ivanov, how to whistle. And the word he's whistling is mama.
Today, you will do your first word in the whistling language, which is mama. But first, you will do it separately. Mama. Not mamu. Mama.
Here, I was watching this last night and I thought, is the Clangers coming through on some other channel there? You know, the Clangers, the kiddies program with the whistling aliens out in space. Rogue, what did you make? First of all, this is a kind of a thriller, but this director is not going to give you a straightforward thriller. And it's a kind of a thing about whistling, but it's about a whole bundle of other stuff as well.
Yeah, so I think you have to situate Porn Boyo's work within the era of Romanian New Wave, which is this genre of film that came out during the noughties, and it's realist, it's minimalist, it's austere, it's darkly funny. And the way that I approach this film is it's kind of like if the Coen brothers plotted a film, but if a very serious Eastern European director directed it, because the aesthetic of it is deliberately drab, the performances are deliberately understated. It's really darkly funny, but only if you get on board with the fact that these are completely eccentric characters, but they're not eccentric performances. So the entire plotting of it is very traditional, kind of neo-noir genre. Mm. The characters are kind of heightened. There's this ridiculous OTT femme fatale, but she's played incredibly straight. And that's kind of where the humour comes from. It's very dry. It's very sly. And even you have this motif of the whistling, which is taken so seriously in the film and is inherently very silly and very ridiculous. And in another director's hand, this would become something outrageous and hilarious. But funnily enough, I came out of this film going, there's not enough whistling. And that's what this director does, is he underplays everything that could be absurd to a really interesting degree.
OK, so you certainly get that in terms of the whistling. I wanted more of it. I wanted to be able to speak whistle by the end of it. I didn't succeed. But what he also does, Chris, and I think it's noteworthy, is the way the film is structured in chapters, almost colour-coded chapters attached to each character.
Yes, color-coded attached chapters for each character. So that should tell you that Porn Boyo is clearly trying to have, if not his own, you know, Coen Brothers or Martin McDonagh moment, certainly his own Tarantino moment. And I found that both engaging and frustrating, the same way I found the plot of this film, but elaborate and overcooked. And it's just that things get a little bit confusing. You know, you find yourself asking, why does Christie have to go to this island? Why does he have to whistle in the first place? And just like what Ro was saying there, I think if any other director had the whistleblower of the piece literally learning to whistle, I wouldn't have gone along with it. But it's the tone that always saves it, because a lot of these characters, again, like what you were saying there, they're so over the top, they're so ridiculous, but they're played very straight by the actors. And that's what makes the difference here. That's what leaves a mark. And though sometimes I would have preferred had, you know, Porn Boyo maybe kept to a more linear narrative, a more linear structure, so that, you know, half the time I wouldn't be asking who he is or who she is. It does work. Now, in the end, it kind of ends up, you know, in the third act, it sort of ends up, you know, chasing its own tail, and it's in desperate need of a strong finale, a strong payoff, and it's not quite as satisfactory as I hoped. Mm. But I think it's the performances that make all the differences. And going back to Katrina Marlon, she's playing, you know, that over the top femme fatale, as Ro was saying. I thought she was quite brilliant here, because there could have been a temptation to just have her as you know, even the film is sort of setting out its stall at the beginning and saying here's the you know, the old fashioned eye candy of the piece, but it's not. Here's as fully formed a character as everybody else is in this ridiculous setup. Mm. And even though I had my problems with it, I did quite enjoy it.
Yeah, and surprise, surprise, her chapter is in red, and she comes in this flaming red dress at the beginning of that chapter. Did you feel she was a fleshed out character, Ro?
I didn't, and I think that was my problem with this film, is that I think the director's work is so interesting, and he takes very traditional genres, and he takes things, and he has this disingenuously deadpan wit, and he kind of sneaks up on you with a sly sense of humour. But I feel that within this kind of neo-noir crime caper, the archetypes are so deeply embedded and so familiar that there isn't that room to pull one of those kind of dazzling switches and to surprise us in that way. And I felt that Gilda couldn't quite escape the thinness of that traditional femme fatale role. And in the opening sequence, because I was familiar with the director's work, there is an opening sequence where, we won't give too much away, but she comes up with this plan to escape noticed by the police who are tracing them, and it is a ridiculous move that feels very stereotypical of the femme fatale. And as the film goes on, I think you notice that this is his attempt to show how outrageous this is, but from the opening it feels a bit objectifying, so I didn't feel like it transcended these archetypes quite enough to be as funny as usual.
Initially there is a scene that's problematic, I would have thought, but as it goes on you realise, oh right, they're playing the type to say to us, isn't this a ridiculous type? Did it work overall for you then, Chris, and stars before we move on to the second film from Parham Boyle?
It doesn't quite have the payoff that I wish it had, and I think it is a little too clever for its own good. You know, as I said, it kind of just gets tied up in knots towards the end, but I enjoyed the performances. I thought I'd love to see more about Parham Boyle, because before this week I wasn't actually familiar with his work before this, so looking forward to seeing other films that he's worked on, but it still held my attention and it's probably still one of the best films I've seen this week. So we'll go with 3.5 out of 5.
All right, and from you, Ro?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a low-key, deliberately understated film with this twisty, globe-trotting plot. It's fun. I wish it had more offbeatness, more eccentricity. I think just it's too embedded in archetypes to be as entertaining as I would like. So I'm going to give it a 3.
All right. Understated is certainly a word I would use for the third film and the second one from Cornelio Parham Boyle. Busy guy this week, Chris. A film about football. Or is it even about football? I don't really think it is. Lorenzo is a mid-range official in local government in a Romanian town. He has an obsession with football. And kind of, it's not really five-a-side, but it kind of looks as if it's going to be five-a-side. Let's not get bogged down in how he wants to change the rules. He wants to change the shape of the pitch, for starters, into an octagonal shape. That's one thing. Then he wants to, you know, bog the men down or the players down in different sections of the field that they can't move out of. Is this film about football at all, Chris?
I don't know what it's about, Sean, to be honest. I think Parham Boyle, you know, he's friends with Lorenzo. His father himself, Parham Boyle, that is, was a referee, I think. And, you know, there's a big football connection with the family. And he must have been sitting around with Lorenzo one night when Lorenzo let him in on this story of, you know, him at the age of, I think it's 18, 19, he was a student footballer. He suffered a heartbreaking injury to his leg, although we never know quite how promising a career in football he would have had ahead of him. Maybe he was average, maybe he was great, we don't quite know. But he suffered this injury, he broke his leg. It wasn't treated properly, and as a result it never healed properly, and he never got over this, and he thinks that because of the rules, because of the rules of football and the way they've been for decades, for a century, it that, you know, if he changed how the game was played, if he changed the size of the pitch, if he made sub teams within the teams playing one another, it would change the momentum of the ball, it would mean less injuries for players. We won't get bogged down in the details, but basically he's devoted a lot of his spare time in his life, how much we're not quite sure, to devising a new kind of football, and he is genuinely going around and meeting with football boards, or at least he says he is, to see if anyone will buy this.
I suppose the title of the film is Infinite Football. I think possibly the first word might tell us more about the kind of ideas that were in Parham Boyle's mind. Look, the simple fact is he wants to take four men, let's say, and place them. They're going to be the backs. They never move out of the bottom quarter of the field. The forwards never move out of the top quarter of the field. It's kind of that type of thing. But it moves from a discussion of football into superheroes, Ro. It moves from there into a discussion about translations of the Bible and how, in fact, the word repent is not repent but change. It moves into a whole set of philosophical arguments.
Yeah, I think what's really interesting about this film is that it's only 70 minutes, and I feel like I went through every emotion possible during this film, because at times it just feels depressing because you're listening to this man and thinking this is like listening to your friend's uncle down the pub explaining how he fixed the offside rule, and it's all coming because he really believed that he would have been a professional football player. And then you see this character and you see him in his bureaucratic day job, and they don't give too many details, but there's kind of this Kafka-esque interaction with a woman in her 90s who wants to get some paperwork done about a building that went up unlawfully on our land 27 years ago. And it's this idea of bureaucracy and red tape and rules holding everybody back. And it seems depressing. And then he reveals that he had tried to go to America several times and visa complications. And then the restrictions that came in after 9/11 stopped him. And so there is this element of how rules are holding people back, not only him individually, but people in Romania generally. And is the football idea just a metaphor for trying to get more freedom for people and more fluidity? But then he gets bogged down by his own rules, which is the deep irony of it.
And then we get a photo snap of his wedding out of nowhere, Chris. And his father comes in, Laurentiu's father, and starts to talk about what makes a good photograph. Now, I don't know, I heard Rose saying she went through almost every emotion in 70 minutes. I found myself that I thought, oh, what's this about? Then it was like either watching a car crash or watching paint dry. I wasn't sure which, but I couldn't take my eyes off it. Were you as stuck into it as I was?
I tell you, Sean, I got so frustrated with this film because at one stage I paused it and I actually sketched out the pitch and the idea of what he was talking about. And I came to the conclusion that if you have players doing nothing for most of a football game, they're going to cool down, which is only going to open them up to more injuries. And I'm annoyed at Porumboyo that I actually put that much thought into it. And I thought it was quite sad because we're moving from, there's one stage he's comparing himself to Superman. Then you're right, he goes over we go inside this house and there's all talk of his wedding and his father showing photos of the wedding. And I just felt so sorry for this guy, because going back to Rose's point about almost getting stuck with your uncle or something, I felt like I was sitting beside someone on a bus who told me about this plan they had for a game that they never got up and running. And I just felt so sorry for this guy. And I actually got to the stage where I thought, Porumboyo, this is not right. I don't think we should be watching this, because I really don't think an awful lot of thought went into what kind of film he wanted to make here. And I just think that's a shame, because there could be a good idea for a documentary. But also in terms of documentary making, it's sort of thrown together. It sort of looks like something Porumboyo did on A Long Weekend. And I think that's a shame, because I kind of wish I hadn't seen it. I just felt so sorry for the guy.
All right. I presume this means very low in terms of stars from you anyway, Chris.
It does, I'm afraid. You know, as I said, I'm so frustrated that I put that much thought into it, but I actually think I put more thought into it than Porumboyo did. So again, there is a good idea for this. There is a good idea for a weird, I don't know, office type drama about some local bureaucrat who thinks he can reinvent football. We can maybe talk about that another day. But for the time being, the film that we got, it's not very well put together. So I'm only going to have to give it 2, I'm afraid.
Were you as frustrated? I didn't spend time trying to work out the tactics. Were you as frustrated, Ro?
Definitely for the first 10 minutes, I was like, what am I watching? And I don't even like football. So I was thinking, really, do I have to watch this? But actually, as it went on, I kind of enjoy, again, that really ultra minimalist, deliberately drab, austere aesthetic, because I think it forces you to pay attention to what they're speaking about and to analyze the subtext, because the presentation is so deliberately dull. And I think there's something interesting that it's sly and it does it deliberately, and it makes the film open to allegorical and political interpretation. And I think the parallels between kind of the nation's troubled experience of authoritarianism, everybody's desire to get rid of the systems and structures that govern our lives, are really interesting. So I kind of enjoyed how bizarre it is.
It's untraditional
entertainment. 3.5.
3.5 from you for Infinite Football and The Whistlers, the other Porumboyo film. The both of those are available on Curzon Home Cinema. And the other film we spoke about, Becoming, is available right now on Netflix. Chris Wasser and Ro McDermott are reviewers this evening. Daddy. There of Lisa Hannigan and A Little Taste of Lille, which was recorded at Other Voices Berlin last year. And at 8 p.m. this evening, Lisa will be performing live at Other Voices Courage from the National Gallery. And you can stream that via YouTube, Facebook Live and RTE.ie. And then at 11:30 this evening, the Other Voices Courage series will start on RTE2 television. 26 minutes to 8 on Thursday night, Serena. And now to our occasional series, Where Do I Begin With? We've already discussed where to begin with the work of Serge Gainsbourg. Tonight, it's the turn of the incomparable Kate Bush. And here with a guide on how best to delve into the vast collection of Kate Bush albums is fellow musician and sound designer Alma Kelleher, also known as Lux Alma. I suppose, Alma, for many people, Kate Bush, they'll probably think Wuthering Heights, and they might know one or two other things along the way. Babushka was the one that kind of jumped out for me. But, you know, it's such a vast catalogue. How would you describe Kate Bush as an artist?
Oh, where do I begin with that? I suppose, well, as you said, she's really incredibly prolific, and she's had 10 studio albums. It's kind of like art rock or something, and occasionally art pop and art popera and all kinds of different I suppose, so genre-defying is probably the best answer there.
Genre-defying so from an early age, from her teen years, in fact.
Yeah. So, like, she was, her first song, her first release was Wuthering Heights, which was released when she was 19. Massive, massive hit, and it was the first ever self-penned number one for a female artist in the UK. But she had, even by then, she had already amassed a massive collection of songs. She was, I suppose, discovered is probably the word, by David Gilmour of Pink Floyd. And he met her when she was 15, and she had already written over 100 songs by then. And she played 30 or 40 of them for him. And yeah, he immediately got her signed, and the rest is history.
All right. So in answer to our question, where do I begin with, you actually brought us to 1985, The Hounds of Love, her fifth studio album. Why did you bring us, or why are you saying start here?
Start in the middle. because I suppose that Hounds of Love is renowned as her best album. It's a spectacular piece of work, and I feel like it's the epicentre of the sound of Kate Bush. So you can work outwards from there in any direction. But it's really, it has some amazing, you know, hits on it, like Hounds of Love itself and Running Up That Hill. But it also has the whole second half of the album is like a concept suite about a person drifting alone in the sea. It has its own name, the second half of the album. It's a capsule of everything that's great about Kate Bush.
And in fact, in that second half of the album, The Ninth Wave, the kind of the title given to side two, if you like, Bill Whelan, Donal Lunny and Liam O'Flynn and other Irish musicians involved in there as well, because she goes into an Irish musical language, I suppose, in some ways. But Cloud Bursting, I think, is probably the most important track or the most important video and piece of art on this album.
Yeah, it certainly resonates with me the most deeply, and I can't stop coming back to it. You know, every couple of months, I won't just listen to it, but I'll really sit with that song because there's so much in it. A little bit like Wuthering Heights, it's based on a book. So actually the first time, you know, first couple of times I listened to it, I assumed it was a love story, just something for her, and then found out it's about the book and read the synopsis of the book, and the lyrics are exactly that. They're a synopsis of
Well, tell us
book.
The book. The book is called The Book of Dreams by Wilhelm Reich, I would guess, if he's German.
Yes. It's by Peter, his son, and it's about Wilhelm Reich, who's his dad. And it's basically charts the life of Peter and his father. And Wilhelm was an inventor who created a machine called a cloudbuster, which was a very real thing. So he was hired by the state of Maine in the 50s to create like a something to treat drought. So it was like a machine that pointed up and tried to gather clouds. And he was, the father was eventually taken away during the McCarthy era for his ties to communism. And the song and the book are about the boy remembering his life on the farm called Organon and the day that his father was taken from him.
So Little section there from Cloud Bursting from Kate Bush, that from her album Hounds of Love, her fifth studio album released in 1985, and the place that Elle McKelleher is suggesting that we start in a way to find ourselves delving into the artistic output of Kate Bush. If you started in the middle, then for your second step, you're going to go back in time again to 1980, in fact. And it's the album again here, third studio album, this time Never Forever, Alma.
Yes, that's the very one, yeah. So this one, you can kind of hear, with Hounds of Love, Kate was very much in the driving seat as a producer. She had bought her own studio, so she was on her own dime and her own time. So she made the whole album at her own pace. And with Never Forever, this was her first foray into being in charge of producing. So she co-produced this album. And so it's the first time you can really hear that the songs aren't just songs, but they're sound and music journeys all in and of themselves. So you can really start to hear the exciting sounds. And she uses something called a Fairlight sampler, which was introduced to her by Peter Gabriel. And it's like a synthesizer where you can record your own sounds and then you play it back on a keyboard as if it's an instrument. So this was the beginning of the opening up into that real deep, rich sound for her.
Yeah, and some of the extraordinary ideas behind the songs here. I want to play Babushka, which I'll play in a couple of minutes' time, but maybe tell me about the ideas behind Breathing, for example.
Yeah, oh, I absolutely love this. This one finishes out the album. And the song is essentially from the point of view of a fetus, and it's worrying about birth into a post-apocalyptic or post-nuclear world. So this one, you know, being written in the early 80s is specifically about nuclear fallout. But I think, you know, at the moment, I think we can all relate to a world where you've been cocooned and then you go outside and breathing, you know, could be damaging to you, but you have to breathe anyway. So it's that, but it's also relationship to your mother and all kinds of amazing stuff. And it grows into this epic choral beauty.
And motherhood and a maternal attitude is also at the heart of the song Army Dreamers.
Yeah, yeah. So Army Dreamers is about the futility of losing a son at war. And Kate Bush was, you know, 22 or 23 when this song was released. And yet she totally embodies the viewpoint of what it must feel like to lose a son, which is an astonishing thing to be able to do at that age.
Finally then, in terms of this album at any rate, tell me a little bit about Babushka. It started running in the background here as well.
Yeah, so Babushka is a story about a wife's desire to test her husband's loyalty. And so to do so, she takes on the nom de plume of Babushka and sends notes to him pretending she's a younger woman just to test him. And the adventures that come thereafter. And how she was when she was beautiful. She signed the letter.
Babushka there from Never Forever, Kate Bush's album from 1980. And interesting video alongside that track as well. Elle McKelleher, who's speaking to us about Kate Bush this evening.
Yeah, so Kate Bush was always really interested in dance and in mime. And she saw David Bowie in the early 70s and his use of movement. So she went off and got lessons from the same guy. And all of her videos, pretty much all of them thereafter, have an element of dance and movement in them. And in the video for Babushka, in the verse, she dances with an upright bass. So her male partner is an upright bass. And she's shrouded in this black cloth. And then the chorus comes and she's Babushka in this gold warrior outfit. And she's dancing around. And she plays both parts, which I love.
And the motherhood theme, or the, I suppose the grandmotherhood theme, picked up on in the fact that Babushka means grandmother, but she didn't realise that seemingly at the time she wrote the song.
No, she didn't know what it meant.
Okay.
But I think she made her own of it, so it's okay.
1989 then is where you're bringing us for your third choice for us to delve into the works of Kate Bush, The Sensual World. This is a different style of piece altogether.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of a signal of what's to come through the 90s and, well, through the 2000s anyway, with Kate Bush. It's a more grown-up thing, a more intimate sound, but it's still really personal, but it's no less fantastical, I suppose. Mm. It's still, it's flights of fancy, but the songs are on a smaller scale. It's not about nuclear war or, in Wuthering Heights, the kind of, it's very heightened. Whereas with these, it's much more internal and much more personal. So you can hear her maturing in this album, which I think is really exciting.
And a literary source here, certainly in terms of the title track for The Sensual World, James Joyce and Ulysses.
Yeah, so it's the title track, The Sensual World, is based upon Molly Bloom's monologue at the end of Ulysses. Though she couldn't actually get the rights for the real words, so she wrote it to the actual words of Ulysses, but then had to change them around a bit afterwards because she wasn't allowed to use it. But the sense of it is still very much there, you know, and talking about the seed cake and the internal, I suppose, exploration of the body and joy and sense.
Yeah, and in fact, once again, Bill Whelan and Donal Lunny and Davy Spillane, in fact, involved in this album too. Finally then, we're going to finish up with This Woman's Work. Why is that song so important to you?
There's something about Kate Bush's work, even at her most fantastical, she has a way of getting straight to the heart of something emotionally. And this song, the very first chord and the very first note is enough to break your heart and mend it all at the same time. It's just utterly beautiful. It was written for a film, a John Hughes film, She's Having a Baby. And the song was originally used at that, the kind of crux moment of the film where the husband is standing outside the delivery room and he learns that his wife and new baby are potentially in danger.
All right.
And he kind of flashes. Yeah.
Well, grand. Listen, thanks for sharing your thoughts on the work of Kate Bush with us this evening. That's Alma Kelleher there. And we'll finish up with a little bit of This Woman's Work. All the things I should have said that I never said. All the things we should have done that we never did. All the things I should have given that I did. I'm all darling, make it go. Make it go away. This Woman's Work from The Sensual World, the final album that Lux Alma or Alma Kelleher is sending you to. Also have a listen to, starting out with Hounds of Love and Cloud Busting, in fact, Sean, and then go to Never Forever and Babushka. Pew is the third novel from Catherine Lacey, the American author whose many accolades include a Guggenheim Fellowship in 2019 and who has just been longlisted for the 2020 Sunday Times Short Story Award, and that's for her story Cut. Her new book takes place over the course of a week in which a small town in America's deep south is electrified by the arrival of a mysterious young person found sleeping on a church pew. This really, Catherine joining me this evening on the line, it really is, or starts out as, a stranger comes to town, and a very strange stranger, for nobody can make out who he, she, it is.
Yeah, that's right. I tend not to think of my characters so much as people, so much as systems of thought. But with this book in particular, I wanted to make even more of a leap, to have a character that was absent of all sort of human characteristics, which is, of course, is completely impossible. but I wanted to try anyway.
And in fact, you say it is a difficult thing to do. I'm sure it was also very difficult for the fictional characters in this town to understand. The character comes to be called Pew because they don't know, the people in the town don't know the gender of the character. They don't know the racial, the ethnic origins of the character. They know nothing about that character or that system of thought,
right.
that background at all. Why did you want to put the other people or the other characters in the book in such a difficult position, or do you consider it difficult?
Well, yeah, they are in a difficult position, which I think anyone would be if you could imagine a person appearing before you and needing some kind of care and for you not to know anything about them at all. It's sort of when I started to think about that sort of fictional situation, I just realized how much we rely upon these sort of exterior signifiers to help us decide how to treat someone.
But I guess,
and yet how kind of brutal that is at the same time, that we need these exterior signifiers to decide how to treat someone.
I guess that is part of the debate you're having in the book. You know, once we put a label on somebody, then we start to treat them accordingly. If we don't have a label, we're kind of left at, are we left at sea as to how to treat them?
Well, yeah, I mean, and we do need labels both for ourselves and for other people. And you know, it's kind of it's a double-edged sword. And I've been thinking, I mean, like anybody, I've been thinking a lot about the way society and individuals use identity to sort of create connections and then create divisions as well.
Story is set in the Deep South. You're from Mississippi yourself. How important is the Deep Southern setting to the story that you're telling?
Well, I think I use the South not in order to make a point about the South or to reveal something about the South in particular, but because I think the South is a kind of a useful way to think about America. Everything that we have that's wonderful and terrible about this country is in the South in its highest concentration, I think. And so if you think of like an outsider sort of wanting to know something about this country, I think starting with the South is maybe a fast route to sort of see the good and the bad.
And you talk about what's wonderful and what's awful about this country. Could you give us a sense of what those two extremes are for you at the moment?
Well, I think, you know, just historically, I think some of the best literature and music and food has come from the South. And yet I think you can see the kind of the religious origins of America are still there, and they're foundational in a way that they're not in the rest of the country. And then, of course, we have the ugliest scars from slavery and civil war and Jim Crow and income inequality and oppression of women and all those great things. But I don't know. There's a kind of sense of place there that is it's hard to deny, you know.
Initially, it's a white couple, Hilda and Stephen, who take in this pew. Will I use the pronoun they or them for pew, who brings them into the house? Their kindness seems to be provisional.
Yeah, it's just kind of incidental or accidental that pew sort of falls into their hands.
But the provisional nature of that kindness, or the provisional nature of their initial taking on the character of pew, were you getting at something specific in that?
Well, I do think it's interesting that they first encounter this person on a Sunday in church, and so sort of on their maybe, you know, in a kind of exaggerated way, the best version of themselves are the ones that initially encounter this person. And then as the week goes on and sort of life intercedes and their children don't get along so well with having this stranger in the house, you know, their more protective, more self-centered nature eventually comes out.
The other thing I have to ask you, because I've heard the noise twice now, are you near a subway line or something like that? Is that what I'm hearing roaring past you there?
I can't believe you can hear that. I actually am quite near elevated tracks of the Blue Line in Chicago, but I can barely hear it. I'm amazed that you can pick up on it.
Oh, radio does. It'll pick up anything like that you don't
Sorry
want it to pick
that.
Up. No, don't worry about it. It's absolutely fine now that we know what it is. Wealth becomes an interesting discussion here as well in terms of another couple that we get to meet later on, Kim or Kitty and her husband, Butch, who live in this huge mansion, and they have an adopted son, Nelson. How important was it to you for you to talk about that divide from the, you know, the really wealthy to the really poor?
Well, I mean, that's something else that I think is I don't think I had to intentionally put it in there. You know, I sort of just followed the character around the setting as I could imagine it. And I think these, you know, the issues of income inequality in America right now, especially with the coronavirus, are just so stark and just practically criminal. And so I think that, you know, that's been on my mind my whole life. And so I think that anything I think a writer thinks about a lot ends up coming out in their work just naturally.
And the fact that that Kitty and her husband Butch have an adopted son, was there something within the adoptive parent relationship that you wanted to explore?
Well, I think, you know, when I was writing this book, it's rather claustrophobic. You know, I knew it was only going to take place in the course of a week. I knew it was going to happen, going to be narrated by a character that wasn't necessarily speaking. And so I had really boxed myself in terms of where I could go. And I think with those constraints, I naturally sort of gravitate towards characters that will say and do things that maybe the rest of the characters won't. And so Nelson, you know, I always hesitate to say that I think of my characters as people because I mainly don't. But if the characters were people, I would want to be around Nelson. I think he's got a kind of pluck about him that that I wanted Hugh to be able to interact with someone who could see them in a way that the rest of the characters couldn't.
I want to briefly mention the Forgiveness Festival, which comes in later on in the book, and it moves us into quite a disturbing type of atmosphere within this small southern town. Did you have a specific model in mind for that festival? You might explain what the festival is within the logic of the book, first of all.
Right. I mean, in some ways, I think all sort of religious rites that we've come to think of as totally normal, like communion, for instance, they're all kind of absurd. You know, it's funny to me that, like, for instance, like Scientology, in pop culture, people will point to this and say, oh, this is so crazy. Look at all their like insane behaviors. But I think, you know, pretty much every major religion has these rites and rituals that have become normalized. And so the Forgiveness Festival is really just, it doesn't matter necessarily that it's a festival, just that there's this event that everybody is sort of approaching that they think is going to transform them in some way.
Yeah, and we should leave it at that, because that's what people will find out what that transformation is when they read the book. That's Catherine Lacey there speaking to me about her latest novel, Pew, which is published by Granta. And that is our lot for Thursday night's Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research this evening. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision was by Pather Carney. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Don't forget, you can listen back to anything on the programme. And indeed, you can get our podcasts of the programme wherever you usually get your podcasts. Go to rte.ie for full details. Talk to you tomorrow at 7.